This is a slide of the statue of Roger Williams, who was the founder of the colony of Rhode Island in the early Americas. I mentioned the other day, and we should be familiar with this only in the fact that of all the colonies in the New World, Rhode Island was the one that was established on the basis of freedom of religion for all. While it was a generalized statement in the colonies, and it certainly came to be the essential American way of doing things, it was not always so, and that whenever any religious denomination had enough power, they pretty much enforced the doctrines and beliefs of that religious organization. So we can at least be thankful for Roger Williams, because it was in his colony that God could establish his church. Next slide. We can get it. This is the oldest surviving church building in the United States of a Sabbath-keeping church. You'll notice that it was built in 1729 on the plaque that's in the front of it. This is in Newport, Rhode Island, the oldest Sabbath-keeping church in America in Newport. This building built in the early 1700s. It is now in control of the Seventh-day Baptists. Prior to 1818, there was no such denomination as the Seventh-day Baptism, or the early 1800s. I'll get to that exact date later. It was 1818. Prior to 1818, there was no such thing as Seventh-day Baptist as an incorporated denomination. They were simply called Sabbatarians in the early American colonies. And that is the one most dominant name you find in this period of time, Sabbatarian. This is the plaque outside the meeting house. The first churches were built founded in the 1600s, late in the 1600s, but it was not until now in the 1700s that they could begin to build buildings. Okay? Move along through these fairly quickly. I don't know if we can get a better adjustment. Maybe my angle is bad. Is that a reasonably decent adjustment? Nope. Yeah, that's a little better. This is the building in Newport, Rhode Island, existing since the early 1700s. It is now a museum. It's very well worth your time to go to if you're in and around the Rhode Island area. If you go near Rhode Island, it's not far to Newport, because Rhode Island's very small. Smaller than Los Angeles, I imagine. Easier to get around in. It's quite a nice brick building. Withstood time. They have the meeting hall in the back and then other rooms upstairs. Quite small, of course, by our standards today. And it has been modernized over a period of time, but this is essentially the same building that was the first church of Sabbath keepers, among the first Sabbath keepers in the colonies. I don't know if we can get a better focus on that. Some of these are plaques to read. There we go. This is the first Seventh-day Baptist Church of Hopkinton, Rhode Island, founded in 1672. The plaque commemorates it to 1935. I'll let you take the time to read it there. Early 1700s, you can see they were established. She mentions a number of the nearby communities and some dates passing through time. Okay. Another plaque. This is near what is called the Meeting Hall Bridge, which is an official historical monument bridge not far from the area. This is near Westerly, Rhode Island. Cross the bridges to go to the church. The old grist mill. See in the middle on the hill to the northeast of the first meeting house in southern Rhode Island, built by Seventh-day Baptist in 1680. That building, of course, no longer standing. The one I showed you is the longest standing building, but some of the other buildings built clear back in the 1600s. Notice that some of the members of the church were imprisoned. Hostile natives, it's hard to imagine fighting Indians in Rhode Island. In the colonies, you think of that being something happening in Kansas and Montana and Texas, but not in Rhode Island. Notice, too, Governor Samuel Ward, who was a leader in the struggle for independence, and was on the founding board of Brown University, which is one of America's prestige universities in the Ivy League tradition back east. And in the pool nearby, more than 3,000 were baptized. Lots of Sabbath keepers in the colonies. It's a not very well-known fact. And the colonies were still very small in this period of time, and Sabbath keepers were dominant in Rhode Island. The governor, as I mentioned, Sam Ward, was not apparently a Sabbath keeper during his tenure of governor and during the earliest struggles for American independence. But he was, before his death, baptized and a Sabbath keeper. His wife, for many years, had been a Sabbath keeper. Okay? This is the bridge in the back. This is called the Meeting House Bridge. And here is the area where they baptized, just right down into the water there. There were hundreds and hundreds of Seventh-day keepers baptized in the early American colonies, late 1600s through the middle of the 1700s, up to American independence. But they were overwhelmed in numbers in the course of time, and it was not popular to keep the Sabbath. So it apparently just didn't grow in the way that you would have expected from the numbers who were here at this time. Okay? That's just the plaque on the bridge. The Meeting House Bridge, that's the one I just showed you. Okay? This is just for interest's sake. At the same time, I don't know if you get a little better focus on the white plaque here. This is the oldest surviving, continuous, in operation tavern in America. Right in the heart of Sabbath Keeper country. I don't think, however, they were involved in drinking. The nearest information I can get, that the Sabbath Keepers at this time were very strict, very puritanistic in their approach to life, very strictly regulated community. You think it's bad at Ambassador College. It would have been a whole lot worse at that time. I hope none of you really thinks it's bad, but comparatively speaking. So I just threw this little tavern in because it was there. It's a nice place to have lunch and a grog if you're in the area, though. The oldest surviving, the oldest continuing operation tavern in the colonies. Now, some of you from England, you'll say, man, that's nothing. You know, that's the date is 1673 on it, when it was constructed. So you can go to lunch in lots of places in England, a lot older than that. Okay. This is Stephen Mumford's house. Remember we talked about Stephen Mumford being the... This is what they think. The historians are not absolutely positive. It is dedicated with a monument as being Stephen Mumford's house. Stephen Mumford, the first Sabbath-keeping pastor of churches, coming from England in the late 1600s, establishing this church, Newport, Rhode Island, the churches, and this was his home. Not too shabby, really, considering it was built in the late 1600s. Not a poverty-stricken man, in other words. Many people came to the colonies and succeeded financially. So Stephen Mumford's home, if this is his, but they do note historically that it's possible, it's not positively identifiable, but it is dedicated as a monument. Okay? And this is a list of Sabbath keepers in Hopkinton, Rhode Island. This is in the graveyard, on a monument, and chiseled in stone, someone of the Seventh-day Baptist listed some of the names of people. You might search for your own if you have a Anglo-Saxon surname. See if anybody in there might have been a relative of yours if they come from that time. This was erected on the 225th anniversary in 1982. This monument was put up with the names of some of the folks who were part of the Sabbath Keepers of New England in the town of Hopkinton dating back to 1750s. Okay. This is a book, A History of the Baptists. We've missed some of the top of it, I guess, there. By Backus, B-A-C-K-U-S. This is in the rare volumes collection at the museum in Newport of the Seventh-day Baptists. And it's a book that at least you can be familiar with, because it's not only a history of Seventh-day Baptists, but interestingly in it is a history of the Seventh-day Baptists, who were a very important part of the American colonies. Okay? And here are some pages of the book that I photographed where you can see Stephen Mumford mentioned. The Third Baptist Church in Newport, the others were Sunday keeping. Stephen Mumford came over from London, brought the opinion with him that the whole of the Ten Commandments that were delivered were from Mount Sinai were immutable. Go ahead with the next one. Well, you can't get the top of it there. That's not too critical, but, you know, thank you. We won't take the time to read all of it. So you have the... can you follow the bouncing ball? Okay. We can go on. But there are just a couple of pages out of the book. This is an old manuscript from the late 16, early 1700s, handwritten, of course, at the time, with some of the history of the church and the church records inside of it, some of the things that were going on. Not anything official, but just some of the families and baptism dates. Very, very difficult to read. A couple of interesting little letters and notes that have been maintained in it. Okay? To give you an idea of the handwriting of the Sabbatarian in the late 1600s, or early 1700s, March 15th, 1729. If you stop, to Abigail Baker from our church, what? Meeting, March 15th, 1729. 1729, what did I say? 19, that's the stock market crash. Okay, there is a translation, if you please, a typewritten copy of the letter. Go ahead, I think it's on the next section. This is what the letter says. A letter of admonition to poor Abigail Barker for the evil course of life and keeping bad company, drinking to excess, and not willing to attend God's public worship. And it plainly appears to us that you have become guilty of the horrid sin of adultery, having defiled yourself in a shameful manner. You have been guilty of trying to hide these, and your wickedness goes on with other things. They were disfellowshipping, marking her in the congregation, making public her sins, one of which she was not attending services. Now, everybody had to walk the services in these days. And it was not uncommon to walk as much as 6 to 8 miles among these Sabbath keepers. You read the records of this time. And you were expected to be there unless dire circumstances prohibited you. Think about walking that distance to come to church across that little meeting house bridge and attend that little church congregation. It was a very important part of their life, and this was how they marked and disfellowshipped you from the church in 1729. Okay? Replica of the Mayflower, just to, some of you have seen this perhaps. Not a very good picture, is it? But the Sabbath keepers came over, not on the Mayflower, the original boat in all likelihood, but later in similar vessels to this, coming to the New World to seek religious freedom. Okay. This is an early colonial cemetery near Newport, Rhode Island. And in the cemetery is the grave of Stephen Mumford. Okay. This is a monument honoring the site of the original Hopkinton Church in Rhode Island, long since torn down, but the graveyard that surrounded the church is still there. And the building was moved to a different location, and that new location, I think there is still a Seventh-day Baptist church today that meets there regularly. Okay. And this is one of the monuments to the Seventh-day Baptist church in America, and some of those who were buried there. Began to worship on that site in 1680, and the building stood there till 1852. Many of those buildings, of course, long since torn down, could not withstand the time. The one building that did was a brick building. Most of them were, of course, white frame wood buildings. Okay? Within the cemetery, this is the Stephen Mumford family plot. The black stones there in the foreground, which you can't make out too well. You can see it was a very cloudy day when I was there. But at least you can make out a little bit of it. Okay? This is his tombstone, the body of Stephen Mumford, age 68. I can't get far enough. Departed, what's the year? 1707? The date of his death. It's amazing that a tombstone sitting there that long, you know, virtually nobody pays any attention to. I don't know how on earth Mr. Jimmy Franks, our minister up there, found it, but he went. It took him really months of off and on contacting people and going to these churches and the ministers and the historical records of the museum, and they finally got into the cemetery, but nobody knew where the thing was, and he rummaged around on his hands and knees till he found these gravestones. So it's made it very interesting. Our television crew has been up there and have filmed footage for this, and I think at least once we've had it on the television program. We'll probably come back to a series on church history in another year or two. Okay? Another gravestone. Let's see, who did I put that? Just some of the people. And I don't remember why I put this one in. Mary Tanner. Skip along to the next one. Roger Baster, one of the key ministers of the church in that age, died 1687. So the ministers of the church go back a long ways there. And the last slide is the tombstone, the engraving of Governor Sam Ward of the state of Rhode Island. As I mentioned, I don't think he was governor while he was, I mean, he was not baptized until afterward. There is also a tradition, some history books will have it and most will not, that the Seventh-day Baptists preserve it. That's okay for the slides. There is a tradition, or historical speculation, I guess is the best way to say it, that Roger Williams, the founder of the colony of Rhode Island, before his death, was baptized by Seventh-day keepers. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. We haven't been able to thoroughly document that, but at least it is there. And whether men of that stature, let's say, were ever part of God's church, I don't know. And we should not necessarily presume that everybody who was a Sabbath keeper in the American colonies was representative of God's true church. Any more than to say everybody who has ever been baptized in the worldwide church of God or served in the ministry of the Worldwide Church of God represents the Philadelphia era of the church. Some probably did not. I'm not to judge that. Why they left is their situation to deal with. But I like to exercise at least that caution. So we have Sabbath keeping established in the American colonies in the late 1600s, growing in numbers into the thousands in the early 1700s. In the area of Rhode Island primarily. From Rhode Island, there are congregations that are established in New Jersey in the early 1600s. And I've given you on a handout today, and if you've come in late, there are plenty of extras up here. Be sure to get them for your studies, in case there would be anything on the test in there that you might not get otherwise. 1700s, you have the church moving into Piscataway, New Jersey, and the movement then begins of Sabbath keepers through the 1700s and 1800s, very laboriously slow, but congregations, quite small in number, begin to be raised up in the same westward movement as any American history. They move into New Jersey in the 1700s. Of course, this well precedes the Declaration of Independence. Churches are established primarily in Rhode Island up and through the time of independence. Then in the early 1800s, the problems begin to result, and the significant number of established colonialists now. Independence has been gained. America is a country. There is freedom of religion. Immigrants are coming in by the thousands upon the thousands. And many Sabbath keepers blend into, in style, a very strong Protestant way of life. And that's why in 1818, the largest body of Sabbath keepers in America chose to incorporate under the name Seventh-day Baptist. They at the time were the largest. In 1818, they felt akin to the Baptist belief. Remember, Baptists also have traced their history, not through the Protestant Reformation, but around it, through the Waldensians, much the same way we do. The one major Protestant denomination that does not trace its roots to the Reformation. But the Baptists didn't, and so the Seventh-day Keepers felt more akin to the Baptists and established themselves, but still retained their strong belief that the Sabbath was essential and a doctrine to keep, and thus they incorporated and basically affiliated with the Baptist movement in America. In the meantime, congregations were being established throughout the upper New England to Midwest, through Ohio and out into Michigan. In fact, we would, I think, at this point in the early 1800s, move the headquarters of the church to Grand Rapids, Michigan. In the early 1800s, God's non-Seventh-day Baptist, that is, the remaining Sabbatarian movement, was strongest in the Michigan area. Now, in the 1930s, 1830s, a Protestant named William Miller began the Adventist movement with the doctrine of the second coming of Christ. They became part of the Sabbath-keeping movement during this period of time. William Miller, you should be familiar with him, because we now have the establishment the way we view it, and this will be different from the way they view it. The establishment of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, or the development of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The Adventist movement comes into existence in the 1830s. There was a man named White. I've forgotten his first name here. His wife is more famous than he. What was his first name? James White. Yeah. James White and his wife Ellen G. White also become part of the movement, and Mrs. White claims to be the recipient of many visions, not the least of which was a vision that showed her the Ten Commandments with a ring of fire around the fourth commandment on the Sabbath to convince her about the Sabbath. There were many other visions that she had, and with the development of the doctrine of the second coming of Christ, the Seventh-day Adventists had understood incorrectly that the time of the daily sacrifice, which they counted as 2,300 years, remember in Daniel 8, the prophecy about the sacrifices being suspended in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, maybe in the future too, but there were to be 2,300 sacrifices that would not be offered. But that's morning and evening, so it should have been 1150, but they didn't understand that. They thought it was a full 2,300, and they interpreted it, that symbolized a day for a year, and there would be 2,300 years from the fall of Babylon, I think it was, or from the decree of Artaxerxes, whichever, I've forgotten. But they predicted the second coming of Christ in October of 1844. They had already developed the Advent movement, and they chose to call themselves by the name Seventh-day Adventists, because that summarized the two distinguishing doctrines of the church: keepers of the seventh day and believers in the Advent, that is, the second coming of Jesus Christ. They thought the name Church of God was too common. Sabbath keepers up to this point, many of whom were never affiliated with the Seventh-day Baptist, called themselves the Church of God. But you see, the incorporated rights to do business as a church under the name Church of God had already legally been established by a Pentecostal church in Anderson, Indiana, Sunday keeping, calling themselves Church of God. So legally speaking, you could not use the name for business Church of God. You have to have, in the United States, by law, a distinguishing name different from each other once incorporated. So that's why, if you hadn't understood that, some of the problems came into existence of what are we going to call ourselves. Theologically, there's nothing wrong with the term Church of God, but in order to operate and conduct affairs in the United States, you have to have a distinguishing name different from the other, and that Pentecostal church has the right. So Seventh-day Adventists did not want to retain the name Church of God because of its association with Pentecostalism primarily. And many small denominations, not incorporated, having the name Church of God. So they chose to reject the name of the church in the Bible and to call the church by its distinguishing doctrine, Seventh-day Adventist. Well, you all know that in the 1840s, Jesus didn't come. And so the Seventh-day Adventists had an embarrassing doctrine on their hand, and they came up with the idea that Jesus, when he had ascended up into heaven in the 40 days after his resurrection from the dead, entered into a compartment of heaven, but not the inner sanctuary. And that throughout that period of time, he was pleading, as it were, with the world for repentance, and nobody was. And so in 1844, he gave up on the rest of the world and entered into the Holy of Holies, the sanctuary of God in the heavens, and began preparation for his second coming and calling out the Seventh-day Adventists to do the work of the end time. That's a summary. It won't be exact. I'm probably a little off on things and don't want to be overly sarcastic about their doctrine. But that's in a sense. He began then the investigative judgment in 1844. He's now preparing his church, and Seventh-day Adventists believe that that period of time they call probation is very, you know, can be very quickly brought to an end, just virtually any time now. Boom, it's over. Christ comes for his church and takes all the Seventh-day Adventists away for 1,000 years back to heaven. They don't believe in the millennial reign of Christ on the earth. Ellen G. White saw a vision that the earth would be desolate for 1,000 years, and thus its doctrine. The Bible doesn't say that, but that's what she saw. And I don't doubt she saw the vision either. But what is the source of the vision, I guess, would be our question. Now we have, with the establishment in 1818 of the Seventh-day Baptists, and in 1830s and 40s, up into the 1850s, well, it's 1846, the name is adopted of Seventh-day Adventists. I don't have the date there. In the 1830s and 40s, they adopt the name Seventh-day Baptists. Seventh-day Adventists. We're all tired from last night, I guess. My mind is not functioning clearly. It was a lovely evening, but it doesn't make for a good church history class at 9 o'clock, does it? The Seventh-day Adventists are formed. Now we have three major Sabbath-keeping groups in America. Seventh-day Baptists from the early 1800s, Seventh-day Adventists from the middle of the century, and the continuing Church of God, but basically unincorporated at this time. That's just what they called themselves, Church of God. It was not until the turn of the century into the 1900s that the General Conference of the Church of God appended the name to legally incorporate as Church of God, parentheses, Seventh Day, close parentheses. And that's the official incorporated name of the church. So you have the three movements. Now, each of the three movements claims to be the original church. My analysis of it is simply, we don't have to fight about this, we all go back to a common ancestry prior to 1818 of Sabbatarians. There was no such title as Seventh-day Baptist, certainly not Seventh-day Adventist, and not Church of God, parentheses, Seventh Day, in parentheses. Prior to that time, there were simply Sabbatarians from the 1660s forward through time, 150 or so years of American history in which there was simply a Sabbatarian movement in America. But the Baptist aspect of it gained control of the New England part of it. The Adventists were more moving this way, Michigan, as were then at the time, the movements of the Seventh-day Church of God. The Seventh-day Adventists began to publish in the 1800s. So there were all kinds of people doing these things. 1860s, just going along on our chart now, and that's perhaps the best way to summarize the rest of the class, getting on page 2. Up in Michigan, yeah, here it is. I couldn't remember the date. I thought I had it on here. 1860, the incorporation of the name Seventh-day Adventists. But by this time, a group of Sabbath keepers has moved down to Iowa, Marion, Iowa, in the 1860s. There they begin a publishing work. And there are a couple of publications that you should be familiar with. In the 1860s, a monthly paper called The Hope of Israel began to be published. In the 1870s, the name of the publication was changed to the Advent and Sabbath Advocate. Now, the Church of God at this time, this is prior to the 1900s, because of the influence, perhaps, of what the Seventh-day Adventists had done, but not wishing to be associated with them, often called themselves the Church of God Adventist. Remember, the term Advent or Adventist merely means a belief in the second coming of Christ. Nothing wrong with that title or terminology whatsoever. But you'll see in the earlier literature from this time, this title, Church of God Adventist. Now they've moved away from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, never having been a part of it. The Seventh-day Church of God should never be associated as a part of the Seventh-day Adventist. They went their separate ways, and one doctrinal dispute was the name of the church in this period of time. There are a number of things about it. Duggar and Dodd's book will tell you the story, as will some of the other books that I've mentioned to you in the last class on what we call Sardis era of the church, or the Church of God Seventh Day. Now, I don't know where to start Sardis. I assume it goes back at least into England, maybe into Europe. It would be a rather lengthy period of time, because Thyatira probably comes to a close with the work of not much longer than Peter Waldo. It's hard to say, but very possibly the following Inquisition well might be part of the Sardis era, but as I mentioned way back at the beginning of the semester, it's very difficult to define the beginning and ends of these church eras. So we don't know for sure how they go. So we have come from New England to Michigan to Iowa. And in the 1870s, the Missouri Conference of the Church is formed. And then they begin a loose confederation. This is in the 1880s now, if you're following along in the chart. In the 1880s, a loose confederation called the General Conferences of the Churches of God, Church of God is founded. And it's made up of state conferences. And this is how they organize themselves in government. This time they undoubtedly did not understand church government any way near the way we do. In fact, Mr. Armstrong did not understand church government until the 1950s. He did not understand how church government should function in the 30s and 40s. And he learned it through the school of hard knocks. That's how he learned about it. Then saw in the Bible the form of government that we now have in our church today, which we certainly feel is the example set by Christ and the apostles and the way it ought to be. But they had general state conferences in the 1880s made up from Michigan, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, and Kansas. Other states came along. And in 1888, the official headquarters of the General Conference of the Church of God is moved from Marion, Iowa, to Stanbury, Missouri. If you're in and about Missouri and you see a sign that says Stanbury, it's not much, not a big city by any means. You may have never heard of it apart from the Church of God, and maybe many of you don't really recall hearing much about it until this very day. But this is where the church was headquartered, and its headquartered remained there as a general conference through the time that Mr. Armstrong came into the knowledge of the truth in the 20s and 30s of this century. So the church headquarters, its publishing house, a little school is established in Stanbury, Missouri. The school has long since been abandoned. There still is a little tiny office work that goes on there in Stanberry, Missouri. At least there was the last time I heard. It's been a few years ago. Have any of you got any up-to-date information on Stanberry? Still, I assume it's still there. Don't know any reason why it would have been closed down. So that was happening. Interestingly, about this time, we come to the birth of Mr. Armstrong, as is noted here, the 1890s in Iowa, where God's church had been, although I don't put any special significance on that, that God would have had them moving through that area, because I don't think Mr. Armstrong's people or family was even remotely influenced by the Church of God movement at all. As you note from the autobiography, Mr. Armstrong was reared in the Friends or the Quaker Church, coming from the Pennsylvania area, the William Penn people that had settled there in the colonies. So it was not part of this movement at all. But it was, at least geographically, interesting to note that. Then when 1914, Andrew Duggar becomes president of the General Conference and editor of the Bible Advocate. This is what the publication then becomes known as. Now, if you're ever in Denver, Colorado, the major headquarters of the Church of God Seventh Day is just north of Denver, just in the north suburb of Denver. You're a welcome guest there. They would be happy to have you go, and you can on microfiche look back through. In fact, I think we have, don't we, in our own library? Considerable amounts of the old Bible Advocate on microfiche. Does any of you who work in the library know that for sure? I've never been over to take a look at it. I suppose I should do that. But I think we have a lot of the material on microfiche from the Bible Advocate. But they have that there. And it's interesting to go back into the 1920s and early 30s and see articles Mr. Armstrong wrote and were published in the Bible Advocate at this time. So the vehicle for Mr. Armstrong to begin his religious writing, if you please, is put in place prior to his conversion. Now, he, in the meantime, was being prepared in the advertising field for the job that he would later do. You see how it all starts to blend together at a certain point. But Mr. Duggar is president of the General Conference and is establishing this. Now we're in the time of World War I. There's an interesting account written in the Seventh-day Church of God literature that counts where Mr. Duggar personally, through the state senator of the state of Missouri, was taken to Washington, D.C. to plead the case for the Church of God, young men in the church on military conscription, and to plead the case for Sabbath keepers in the Church of God to not participate in war and be exempt from war as conscientious objectors. That would be a valuable piece of information, especially should you who are U.S. citizens, at some point in the future, you men, and maybe you girls too, depending on the feminist movement and their power, should there ever be military conscription in the United States again, would be valuable information to know that through President Hoover, no, excuse me, I've got my time mixed up, Wilson, President Wilson, that Andrew Duggar personally obtained conscientious objector status for the Church of God. You don't need to go into details about Seventh-day Adventist, Seventh-day Baptist, and the radio/worldwide Church of God. But you could, at least, you could say, well, what is the basis of your conviction? One, it's personal. Two, if you are a conscientious objector, that you carry, your church roots carry back to past, to World War I when it was established that this church would be granted conscientious objector status. Dr. Hay has some information. I have not yet discussed it with him, but when we get to writing this, I will. That in the Civil War, the Church of God, Sabbatarians, were also exempt from military conscription, that they were conscientious objectors in the Civil War. I don't know if we have any information about the Revolutionary War, because we obviously predate the Revolutionary War by approximately 100 years. What our status as conscientious objectors was at that time, I don't have any idea, but I rather strongly feel that they were. There were many, a lot more conscientious objectors than people realize in the American colonies. Because by that time, there were Mennonites and Amish and Quakers were also pacifists. The entire Quaker population of the colonies. It was very difficult and trying times in American history because those people would not fight in the Revolutionary War and yet obtained, of course, the full benefit from it once the victory was secured. Difficult to deal with these things. So certainly Mr. Duggar did his part and was the man leading the church at that time. It was not until 1923 that the incorporation of the church of Seventh Day takes place. The Church of God, Seventh Day. It was not much prior to the time of Mr. Armstrong's coming into a knowledge of it, because as you see in 1926, Mr. Armstrong began to understand the truth through that intensive study that was extant at that time as a result of his wife coming into a knowledge of the Sabbath from a labor lady who was a member of that church group. And here I think it's very important when we discuss the origins of our church, because sometimes for the sake of argument, you just as well say, our church comes from about 1934 when the modern era begins to take place. It depends on who you're talking to. But it should not ever be left to be understood that the church came into existence through the foundation of Herbert W. Armstrong in the 1920s and 30s, because that's not true. Mr. Armstrong came to a knowledge of the Sabbath day first through the Church of God Seventh Day. And his then personal intensive study of the Bible led him to understand many truths, some of which were extant in the Church of God Seventh Day, and of course their literature and ministers contributed the truth about smoking, the truth about unclean meats, the truth about tithing, were extant doctrines of the church. The truth about who the identity of the modern peoples of Israel are and the holy days had not been understood by the church. In spite of the fact that the Church of God Seventh Day understood the Sabbath, they, along with the Seventh Day Adventists, had misinterpreted Colossians 2 to mean that the holy days had been done away with. You know already from taking epistles of Paul and hearing it 50 other times that Colossians 2 does not do away with the holy days. In fact, it establishes the holy days as a shadow of things to come. Don't know why that is not understood by them, but it was rejected by some of them. Now, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, ironically, the Church of God was a very evangelizing church. They had, to use the term in the classic Protestant sense, missionary work all over the world. And in this period of time, there were Sabbath-keeping congregations established in the Philippine Islands, throughout Polynesia, as far away as China, small in Europe, throughout the Caribbean, and perhaps their most fertile field was Mexico through South America. I'm not talking about tens of thousands of people. I'm talking about little congregations. Through the Bible Advocate, the literature published, through evangelical-type ministries, the Church of God was at least spreading the word of these things. Interestingly enough, as a result of Sabbath keepers who migrated to not this part of the New World, but south of our borders, European Sabbath keepers who came to Mexico and South and Central America, joining in with congregations and forming little groups in the Spanish or Latin world, interestingly enough, they brought with them the holy days. Remember when we talked about those Hungarian Sabbath keepers and others in Europe? There were people among them who kept the holy days. Remember the Sabbath hymnal we talked about a few classes back, in which the holy days have dedicated hymnals in their songbook. So when we came in contact in the 1950s, as our broadcast began to go worldwide, and congregations became aware of us in Mexico and South America and our literature, we found among them people who not only kept the Sabbath, but kept the holy days. And they were very excited to find people who kept the holy days, because they knew that the Church of God Seventh Day as a main body, headquartered in Stanbury, didn't. So in the 1950s, I would say, when we had a Latin language broadcast, Dr. Ben Ray, who died of a heart attack, did our broadcast, and for a time thereafter, Pablo Gonzalez did our broadcast for a number of years. His daughters have been through Ambassador College, most of you know. When Mr. Senor Gonzalez was doing our program in that period of time, we had people contacting us, quite a number. In fact, I keep forgetting to ask Mr. Walker this, but a significant number of our Mexican and South American members, especially those who came with us to start, were small congregations, including ministers, who came into the church in the 1950s and 1960s and formed the basis for our work in Mexico and the Latin community southward. So those things were going on during that period of time. It was not an uneventful era in that sense of the word, but as far as truth is concerned, doctrinal truth, they were maintaining the status quo. And what happened in the 1930s, when Mr. Armstrong began to fully comprehend the truth of Israel and the Holy Days and presented it to Mr. Duggar in Missouri. Now, you've read this in the autobiography. It was acknowledged as having value, but could not be taught. I don't think Mr. Duggar believed it. Interestingly, though, and because Duggar came to believe the Holy Days should be kept, but they should only be kept in Jerusalem. So he personally moved to Jerusalem. He lived in Jerusalem until the 1970s. He died a very old man. I don't remember the exact date of his death. But Mr. Duggar had a little work going out of Jerusalem. In the meantime, the Seventh-day Church of God is fragmented into a variety of groups. Out of that group also comes the Sacred Name Society, the Yavists. They are part of the Sabbath-keeping group. That was broken off by Dodd, who wrote the book, A History of the True Church, by Duggar and Dodd. He got that movement going, and so you now have yet another appendage. You have the Seventh-day Church of God, really divided, I don't know how many groups, but Stanbury, Missouri, Denver, Colorado. They used to have a headquarters in Meridian, Idaho, but I think it meshed with the Denver group. There was a small group headquartered out of Lodi, California, just south of Sacramento. There were numerous groups that have split and re-split. But then, I'm not criticizing, because we've got groups that have split and re-split that are made up of former members and sometimes ministers of this church. So we're not criticizing that per se, we're just chronicling the history of it. But in the 1930s, God began to use Mr. Armstrong on the radio and in the printed page to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world. And that is ongoing now. And you can pick up the story well from there in the autobiography. Volume 1, of course, has been slightly revised, shortened a little bit, make it a little easier reading. Volume 2, which will bring us up to present, will hopefully be available for distribution at the Feast of Tabernacles this year, so you can have the complete modern story of what has happened in print so that you can know. So, the unfortunate news as we conclude is that we will have an exam on Thursday at 8 a.m.